It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a look at the fascinating life of Harry Houdini, including his formative years here in Wisconsin. First, while many people stay at home during the COVID-19 pandemic, employees in essential businesses are still showing up for work. Beyond the healthcare workers on the front lines, they include grocery workers, mail carriers, delivery drivers, home health aides, and others. They've been getting a lot of praise on social media, but our guest says it's time to think about how we compensate them, too. Over the last month, she's talked with essential workers in several states about what they want and broke down some models for providing them with hazard pay and other benefits. Molly Kinder is a Rubenstein Fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., where her research focuses on lower-wage workers. Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you talked to a lot of people, as I mentioned, in different essential lines of work. What kind of messages did you hear from them? First of all, just about how they're feeling being out there in the midst of this pandemic.
Right. So over the last few weeks, I've talked to a whole range of workers, from grocery store cashiers to custodians in hospitals, to dietary technicians in nursing homes, to gig workers who are showing up at people's homes and bringing them groceries and meals. And the truth is, most of the people I've talked to are afraid. And mostly they're afraid about what this could mean for infecting their families and getting their loved ones sick. And some of them, frankly, don't feel they are prepared with the right equipment, from masks to gloves, to really feeling safe in their workplaces. So a lot of them do feel that they are contributing, and they do feel that they are helping the country at this important time. But at the same time, a lot of them are, frankly, pretty terrified.
Can you talk about the rates of pay for some of those fields of work you just listed there?
Yeah, so I've been really focusing on workers who make lower than the median wage, so lower wages. And I've talked to workers who make as little as $9 an hour to be a home health aide and care for elderly residents who are really vulnerable to this virus. A lot of workers who are making $11, $12, $13 an hour. And it's a real struggle for them, especially at a time when their family members are sometimes getting laid off. And so they're trying to survive as households on very small paychecks. And they're risking their lives for very little money. And one of the big things that have come out of my conversations is really the fact that a large percent of the essential workers who are keeping our country together and keeping us alive are doing this for not even the dignity of a family-sustaining living wage.
Let's get to the subject of hazard pay. And to introduce it, I want to bring in one of the voices you heard from. You shared parts of some of your conversations with these workers. I want to give a listen to Amber Stevens, a 30-year-old grocery cashier. Here's a listen to some what she had to say about extra compensation.
I think that everybody should be covered with hazard pay if they have to go out and work in these times. But honestly, I don't think you can put a number on how much is enough, because we're risking ourselves as well to help others. You know, so how can you really put a number on my life, my health?
Now, how did what Amber had to say there line up, Molly, with what you heard from other workers when it came to this subject of should they be being paid more during this hazardous time for them?
What Amber said was fairly universal to all the workers I spoke to. Everyone felt that in these times, the risk that they were taking and the fact that a lot of their jobs had become a lot harder, grocery store workers with busy lines, more physically demanding jobs, they really felt like in this time, they should be compensated extra. There was a universal call for hazard pay. It's hard to figure out exactly how much that hazard pay should be, as Amber was saying, like really what is people's lives worth? My personal point of view is that everyone in America who is showing up as an essential worker and risking his or her life for the rest of us at a bare minimum deserve a living wage. And I think we could go even further and pay people 50% more, even in some cases 100% more.
We're talking to Molly Kinder from the Brookings Institution about the idea of hazard pay for essential workers, people who are showing up at various jobs, grocery store clerks, home health care workers, many others being exposed to the illness, worried about bringing it home to their families. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Are you having to show up at a workplace where you are being exposed potentially to the virus that causes COVID-19? Are you getting paid a little extra, a lot extra? Do you think you should be? If you're not, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Molly, as we heard, it's difficult to put a number on things, but you, in a chart in your piece on this, looked at some different options. And actually, some places, local governments, stores, and others are doing some kind of hazard pay or bonuses. What kind of things are we seeing out there in the real world with this right now?
So in the private sector, some of the companies that are needing to hire because business is booming, and that's primarily in grocery stores, in pharmacies like CVS, in big box retailers like Walmart, and in places like Amazon, where our consumer spending is really increasingly going to these stores. A lot of them are offering small increases. So the standard seems to be about an additional $2 an hour for some of this work. But that's not universal. So, for instance, pizza companies that are seeing huge booms in interest in pizza delivery, fast food, a lot of these companies, there's no additional pay whatsoever. Hospitals, home health workers, the folks who are cleaning the hospital rooms for sick patients, a lot of them are not seeing any pay increases at all, despite the risks. There are some leading cities and states that have taken it to providing a little bit of extra pay for their own city employees who are risking their lives. So, for instance, the city of Atlanta has a monthly bonus to some of their essential employees, and the state of Maryland as well. I just saw that the state of Vermont is considering implementing their own version of hazard pay to not only state and public employees, but to everyone. But that's really the exception.
You've also looked at, and I think this is talking to grocery store workers in particular, not just the pay issue, but the protection issue. You touched on that briefly a little earlier. What did you hear from grocery workers about whether they feel enough is being done, given that it's in some stores changing from day to day?
I mean, I think that is the headline, especially in grocery. I started talking to grocery workers 4 weeks ago, and I've kept in touch with them, and it's amazing how quickly things are changing. And to the credit for a lot of employers, they've really scrambled to figure out how do we keep our workers safer. So you've seen, you know, limitations on how many customers are in the store and spacing throughout the store. I think it was Safeway was the first company to announce putting up these plexiglass shields to protect cashiers. I don't think these measures are yet going far enough. It's devastating to see the numbers of grocery workers who've already perished, along with workers like bus drivers who are perishing in large numbers. So some of the grocery store workers, for instance, told me, well, it's great that we have these plexiglass shields, but they're so small, customers are simply just moving to the right. So I think I credit employers for working quickly to figure out ways to make workplaces safer. But to be honest, given the numbers of people who are contracting the virus and who are dying, we probably need to go a lot further.
We heard from some people on the Ideas Network Facebook page. James writes, I'm happy just to be working and still be able to pay my bills. A lot of people are not that lucky. James goes on, the only ones that should get paid more are hospital and nursing home staff. So I've seen that reaction from some other people, too. Glad to have a job, not so worried about the hazard pay. Is that something you encountered at all?
I haven't heard that from the people who feel like their lives are really at risk. So for some of the folks who are in these jobs where they are either because they are face-to-face with a lot of customers. So take a grocery store cashier. The cashiers I interviewed said that in a typical work shift, they interact with 200 to 300 customers who work 2 feet from their face. When I've been speaking with, for instance, gig workers who are delivering meals or mail carriers that I've spoken to. I mean, there's a whole range of workers outside of the health field specifically. Bus drivers are a great example. These jobs are not just theoretically at risk. You're already seeing people dying in those jobs. And the other thing I would say is that I have a particular concern for lower wage workers, many of whom just to get to their job requires taking buses, public transportation, which are highly at risk. I spoke with a woman this morning. She's trying to support a family of six on her sole earnings. $12 an hour as a home health aide. She said taking a bus to work feels like you're taking a bus with a loaded gun and you don't know who's going to set it off. It's so scary. So even just getting to work for some folks who are essential carries risks.
And briefly, Molly, you also heard from people in that situation who, because they're lower income, have more densely populated households. They're more likely to have, say, an extended family, a grandparent, a parent, and kids in the same house. So if they do get sick, social distancing from their families is basically impossible.
That's absolutely correct. I've been talking with a lot of low-income workers whose stories are very similar. A lot of them are women, and they lived with multiple generations in their household. Because they're low wages, they cannot afford rent in cities like Washington, D.C., or in Baltimore, or in Richmond, or these different places where I'm interviewing them. And they're terrified that by going to work, because there's no choice for them. They don't qualify for unemployment if they're too afraid to go to work because of the virus. A lot of them have underlying health conditions. Their family members have had cancer. They have asthma. And by going to work to make these small paychecks just to keep themselves afloat, they're coming home to houses where they can, or apartments where they cannot safely social distance from the people they love the most.
We're talking to Molly Kinder from the Brookings Institution about ideas to extend hazard pay and other benefits to essential workers in things like healthcare, grocery, and other essential sectors that put people at risk. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Are you getting any kind of bump in your pay, big or small, because of the potential risk of catching something and then maybe passing it on? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up that conversation and hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We pick up our conversation with Molly Kinder from the Brookings Institution about how we compensate essential but low-wage workers during the COVID-19 pandemic. She says we should be considering some kind of hazard pay for many of these workers. You can join in with your thoughts and experiences at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to your calls now. Ryan is with us now in Menominee. Ryan, hello.
Hello. So I am a essential worker. I'm a satellite installer, which may not sound all that essential to some people, but apparently television and internet is important to people during this time at home when they're bored. I go into people's homes, go into businesses, that sort of thing, put on a lot of miles, see a lot of people in a day. But because of the COVID-19, people aren't calling in as much as they used to. So my paychecks have been, we get paid by the job, have been a third of what they were last year.
Interesting. So, Molly, thank you for sharing that call. Some risk there, but also people being hit by businesses being cut back, or business being cut back right about now, Molly. Is that something you're looking at yourself?
Yes, and in fact, a lot of my colleagues at Brookings are focusing specifically on the impact that this unprecedented pandemic is having on employment across the board. So not just, I've been focusing mostly on essential workers who are continuing in their jobs, but also a whole range of workers whose work is either ebbing, like we just heard from this caller, or disappearing entirely. And what really need to be some of the policy responses. I mean, I think what I have seen even from workers, I've interviewed some gig workers, for instance, who had similarly, their jobs have started to dry up because of the pandemic. People are staying home. They're not using the same services and businesses. So some folks have turned to the jobs that are still hiring, that are still in demand, even though there's some risk attached to some of them.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Robert with us now in Toma. Robert, hi.
Hi. Where is that money going to come from? You know, that money has to come from somewhere, and that's the customer.
Robert, thanks for the call. So, yeah, the concern is if people have to be paid more, the business has to pay them. A small business maybe can't afford that cost. Ultimately, Molly, could be put along to consumers.
So my proposal that I published about a week ago suggested that this is a time for federal government support. So just like we're seeing all different types of major investments from the federal government through these initial stimulus bills in response to the pandemic, I think this is a clear case for federal government support. A lot of businesses and nonprofits that employ some of these essential workers, I mean, they're struggling right now. This is an unprecedented time. Consumers are also struggling, as your caller just identified. There are some industries where profits are booming. Stock prices are up in grocery, in big box retail, in pharmacy. And in those industries, I think it's a fair question is what is the responsibility as those profits go up to the workers who are the ones risking their lives. But there's a lot of other employees that do not have that benefit. And I believe that this is a moment when really society overall has to ask, what do we owe the workers who are keeping us all alive, who are risking everything for the rest of us? And I believe there's a strong case that can be made for federal support.
Thanks for the call, Robert. Ellen is with us next in Cedarburg. Ellen, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm in Cedarburg. I live here, but I work in Milwaukee. I'm a home health care worker. I'm desperately needed at my client's house. My partner is also a frontline worker, as they call him, in the grocery business. They have thought of offering him and his fellow workers $2 an hour more for 2 weeks, which I consider an insult. My family is very worried about both of us catching it. I'm concerned about my client. I'm concerned that I could give the virus to her, and she is quite ill. I think that huge increases in wages are long due anyway. But for right now, with some businesses making so much more money and hiring so many people, instead of calling us heroes, I'd like to see people get decently paid, like some of the people you've mentioned with families and everything.
Ellen, thank you so much for sharing that story. I appreciate it. Molly?
I mean, I just love everything your caller just said. In fact, my next publication is going to be featuring home health workers, as well as the unsung heroes of hospitals. So the lower paid workers, not the doctors and nurses who definitely deserve all the credit they're getting, but the others who don't get the same limelight and frankly, the same pay and benefits. But home health workers, I just want to take a moment to commend her for her heroic work, not just in this pandemic, but always. There are so many vulnerable, older, immunocompromised people who rely on home health workers to come to their home. If it wasn't for them at the front line, keeping them safe, showing them how to wash their hands, getting them their groceries so they don't have to go out, we'd have so many more people in hospitals, in ICUs right now, and so many more people perishing. And this is a workforce that is so chronically underpaid. Again, the workers I spoke to make as little as $9, $10, $11 an hour, often with no benefits at all, not even health insurance, as they're keeping other people alive. So I am all for increases right now during this pandemic to make sure that workers who are risking everything in these important roles make more now. But these are the kind of things that should be permanent. There's no reason why this incredibly important workforce is so underpaid. And I think this pandemic is shining a really harsh spotlight on this gap between the social value, the societal value that these workers bring, and that gap between what they're actually compensated. So I just want to second her statement that this is an issue it's bigger than the pandemic and should be addressed when this is all over as well.
Ellen, thanks for the call. We're talking to Molly Kinder from the Brookings Institution, looking at the idea of hazard pay for often low-paid essential workers, grocery stores, home health care workers, and many others. Back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Molly, for publicizing this issue. On the weekends, I work in a gas station, a convenience store, and my pay is $10 an hour. And I know that oil companies are making profit nowadays. The price of gasoline across northern Wisconsin is anywhere from $1.40 to $1.70 a gallon, and I heard it's half that. And down in Kenosha County, I heard it's less than a dollar. So I know the money's there with our employer, but they're not paying us anymore, and we don't get any benefits or additional pay for vacation. And during the week, I do deliveries in the electrical industry, and you know, I'm making my same rate of pay. There's nothing extra for that. So I appreciate your publicizing this issue.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Molly, do you, since you've put this out, are you hearing from people in more and more different types of work that are working still and exposed still to the illness?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think your caller is a perfect example. Gas stations, you know, folks who are working at a 7-Eleven or a convenience store. You know, we need these folks to keep working. I mean, CVS is one of the few places I still go for my needs. Gas station I was at the other day. This workforce in retail settings and grocery stores and pharmacies, there are millions of people employed in these jobs, and they don't have the benefits that I think they've long deserved. And we're really seeing that pain point right now as they're risking everything. And I think that the statement that there is money out there is correct. I do think there's definitely more space for companies to step up and really honor their workers and pay them more. And then I also think there is a very large justification for the federal government to do more. Just today, Governor Cuomo of New York expressed his support for federally mandated hazard pay of 50% for essential workers. There's a whole bunch of different Democratic senators who've put forth similar bills calling for different types of hazard pay, some as about 50%. There's another bill that suggests that every at-risk frontline worker should get an additional $13 an hour. So this idea is out there, and I'm pleased to be part of the conversation for why it really matters.
We'll leave it there for now. Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure, and it was really lovely to hear from your callers.
Molly Kinder is a fellow at the Brookings Institution, where her research focuses on low-wage workers. She was with us to talk about ideas for extending hazard pay and other benefits to essential workers during and after the COVID-19 pandemic. Thank you so much for your calls. Sorry to everybody still on the line. We've had full phone lines all throughout this conversation. Thanks so much for sharing your stories. You can keep doing that, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to the author of a new book about the legendary escape artist, magician, movie star, pilot, Harry Houdini, who spent many of his early years right here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a national reporter about what's been happening with everybody's federal stimulus checks related to the coronavirus recovery. First, when you hear the name Houdini, you might think of a performer of worldwide fame in a time when it was a lot harder to become well-known across the world. You may not know that some of his formative years before he actually was known as Harry Houdini were spent here in Wisconsin. Adam Begley is the author of Updike and the Great Nadar. He was a Guggenheim Fellow, a fellow at the Leon Levy Center for Biography, and for many years was the book's editor of the New York Observer. His most recent book is Houdini, the Elusive American, which is part of the Jewish Lives series from Yale University Press. He lives in England and joins us from there. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on, Rob.
Well, let's start in the early years of Harry Houdini. And there's a couple discrepancies. He was born in Hungary. He lived a lot of his early life in Appleton. He said he was born in Appleton, though. Can you talk some of the early days about of Eric Weiss, who later became Harry Houdini?
Yeah, Harry Houdini was born in Budapest in 1874 and moved to the United States when he was 4 years old. And the family settled in Appleton, Wisconsin. And he spent six happy years there wanted, like many immigrants at that time, to become American. And so in later life, he simply asserted that he had been born in Appleton, which was, of course, a lie, but it was one that worked for him.
I imagine, Adam, it's got to be a challenge to be a biographer of Harry Houdini, because in his life, if there was a choice between, you know, the facts and the truth on one hand and the story he wanted to tell and the way he wanted to promote himself on the other, he always went with the best self-promotion possible. Can you talk about that a little?
He was a master publicist for himself. and he never let the facts get in the way. When he was starting to get famous, he went back to Appleton and played, did performances there, and spoke to the local newspapers and told them that he'd been all over the world performing his act. Of course, at that point, he had never left the United States. He just didn't have a particularly cozy relationship with the truth.
Now, he moved from Appleton to Milwaukee after his father lost his job as a rabbi in Appleton. What was life like in Milwaukee for Harry? Again, still Eric at that point.
His father, Samuel Mayer Weiss, lost his job as a rabbi in Appleton because he was really sort of an old-fashioned, old-world European rabbi, and the people of Appleton wanted something a little racier and more modern. So the Weiss family, and there were six children at this point, moved to Milwaukee, where there was very hard times indeed, and they were often just one step away from eviction and had to apply for charity, free deliveries of coal and meat from the Jewish Relief Society. It was a dark time in his life, but he worked for the Milwaukee Journal as a newsboy, and he shined shoes, and he became interested in circuses and magic tricks.
And he, I gather, at the tender age of 9, he first started trying to do his own contortion and trapeze tricks.
Yes, he was precocious and always interested in performing. I think the life in the Weiss family, I mean, we don't know very much about this period of his life, but we know that in 1886, when he was 12, he ran away from home. He left Milwaukee and got about as far as, I think, Hannibal, Missouri, before heading back in the direction of Wisconsin. And he spent some time in Delavan, Wisconsin, which is not far from Milwaukee, where he was taken in by a kindly couple. And he went by the name at the time, Harry White, which is, of course, the English version of Eric Weiss.
Talking to Adam Begley about his new book, Houdini, The Elusive American. We're talking a little bit about Harry Houdini's background, his early days in Wisconsin. Now, Adam, moving into Harry Houdini's career, one of the things that strikes me is I guess the physicality. He was obsessed with physical fitness, learning tricks like at a so-called freak show where he learned how to use his toes to pick things up from a man without arms. If we look at Harry Houdini's tricks, there were tricks that you could teach me and I could try to do them and I could die because I wouldn't have the physical skills. Can you just talk about the physical side of Harry Houdini?
Yes, Harry was a fitness freak. He was quite a good athlete. He was very strong, very supple, very determined to learn the tricks of the trade, which for him was basically dime store museums and circuses and sideshows. And he met a lot of freaks, as they were called at the time, and learned a great deal from them. And what you mentioned there about learning to use his toes was extremely important. He could manipulate keys with his toes with a tremendous amount of dexterity to unlock handcuffs, and among other things. But later in life, he developed some tricks that were really quite extraordinary. One called the Chinese water torture cell involved Harry being lowered by his ankles into a container that was sort of like the size and shape of a phone booth that was filled with water, and then he would be clamped in there upside down underwater, and he would then wriggle his way out. This involved some trick technology, but if you're upside down in a tiny phone booth sized container full of water, you better be pretty supple and pretty quick and pretty strong, or you are going to drown.
He and his brother at one point and his wife at another point, they toured the country doing all manner of performance. There was some, you write, some comedy, some magic, of course, some spiritualism and seances, which I think we'll talk about a little later. How did Harry Houdini end up with Escape Artist as his most famous, his most impressive credential?
Well, he there are two strands to that, really. One is that he early on he used handcuffs in his escapes, and he wasn't the only one to do it, but he did it very well. And he would, where other people, for example, would bind their wrists with rope and manage to break out of it, he would use not only handcuffs but leg irons and all kinds of chains draped around his body, and he would get out of those. The other thing he did was to publicize himself. He would go to police departments and offer to be put in jail, often stripped naked, and they would put his clothes in a different cell and lock them away, and about 15 minutes later, he would be back fully clothed and sometimes even having broken into other cells and moved the prisoners around. And this was, he did this not to, in front of an audience, but to garner publicity. He would get journalists, he would tip off journalists that he was going to go to the jail and do these things, and they would write it up, and he would get publicity for his show in town the next night or the next week.
He toured the country again with his wife for a long time, making not a lot of money, just kind of doing these small shows. There was a turning point, I think it was in the Twin Cities, where he hit the big time. Can you talk about that moment?
Yes. That happened in 1899, and he'd started performing in 1891. And for 5 years, he'd been performing with his wife as the Great Houdinis. And really, they were scraping a living. They so often didn't have enough to eat. They would have to perform maybe five or six times a day. The audiences were bored. The places were really low rent. It wasn't an attractive lifestyle. But they persevered, and he kept at it, and he and his wife were real troopers and real performers. And then one day in 1899, a guy named Martin Beck, who was an impresario with a vaudeville circuit, saw his act and really liked the handcuff escape and offered him a contract. And this completely changed his life. It more or less doubled his pay instantly and gave him security and gave him a proper audience and a little bit of dignity, because vaudeville was a step up in the world from the kind of dime show and circus venues that he had been playing before. And it really changed his life. He in fact, wrote a note on the telegram he got from Martin Beck that said, "This is the moment my life changed."
Author Adam Begley is with us. We're talking about his most recent book. It's called Houdini, the Elusive American. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you familiar with Houdini's Wisconsin connections? If you live in one of the places that Houdini lived, Appleton, Milwaukee, Delavan, do you see signs in your hometown about his life being there? Does his showmanship remind you of some other famous Wisconsinites, the Ringling Brothers, maybe? Do you have a question about something you've heard about Houdini, a legend, a fact, or you're not sure which? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. I'll escape for just a couple moments and then be back with you here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with author Adam Begley about his newest book, Houdini, the Elusive American. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question about the legendary escape artist Harry Houdini. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hello.
Hi, I think we've all watched this very old black and white biography of Harry Houdini. It was entertaining. In fact, it featured the famous water trick that your biographer talked about. But my question is, in the movie, it portrays him as being supposedly obsessed with both the afterlife and contacting his deceased mother. I'm interested in knowing if this is myth or if it's fact, and to what extent this spiritualism or spiritual issue was of importance to him. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. You write a lot about Harry Houdini and seances, fake and otherwise. Could you talk about that a little bit, Adam?
Yes. To answer the question, the first question, I think you're referring to the movie Houdini starring Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh that came out in 1953. And indeed, the Chinese water torture cell does feature there. And yes, Houdini in that is obsessed with the afterlife and with especially contacting his dead mother. Houdini was absolutely obsessed with his mother. And when she died in 1913, it was a terrible blow for him. And he tried very hard to get in touch with her through mediums at spiritualist seances without any luck. And he very quickly saw through the performances that these mediums would give at the seances, because he himself had done a little work in that sideline before deciding that it was, as he called it, a bad effect, something he shouldn't be doing, that because he felt that it made light of the seriousness of mourning the departed. And that it was essentially about tricking people in a bad way, as opposed to the more benign tricking people involved in magic tricks.
Jim, thanks a lot for that. Oh, sorry, go on.
No. I would think we should at some point talk about Houdini's career as an anti-spiritualist.
So right. That's what I wanted to ask about next. He knew how the tricks worked, and he set about exposing them, right?
That's correct. It's starting in the early 1920s, when he was at this point really quite a famous man and famous all over the world, especially in Europe and in the United States. He started taking on spiritualism in a concerted way and even worked this into his performances, theater performances. He would divide his evening performances into three parts: one part magic, one part escapes, and one part debunking spiritualism and seances. And this is, he did this in part because he believed that spiritualism was wrong, and in part because spiritualism was having a huge revival at this time after World War I. And there was a great deal of demand for people who wanted to be put in touch with their departed loved ones. And he saw an opportunity to promote himself by attacking spiritualism, because, as we've said earlier, Houdini never neglected an opportunity to promote himself.
Thanks again for the call, Jim, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Adam Begley, author of the new book, Houdini, the Elusive American. Adam, you introduced me to a couple of chapters of Harry Houdini's life that I had no idea about, including Harry Houdini, aspiring pilot. How did he get into buying and flying planes?
It's a very strange episode in his life. It begins in 1910. When it was right after the first person ever crossed the English Channel in an airplane, and that sort of sparked a mania for airplane flying, and especially in Europe, which is where he was at the time. And he bought himself something called a Voisin biplane, which was this very rickety machine. It was already out of date, obsolete when he bought it. It was basically made of wire and paper, and he flew it once or twice in Germany, and then was going on a tour of Australia. And so he packed up his airplane, put it on the boat, hired a guy to an engineer to take care of it, went to Australia because he thought he would become the first person ever to fly in Australia, which he did become. And he spent 5 months there, basically doing his show, and then afterwards going out and preparing for a flight in the morning in this biplane. And it wasn't much of an airplane. I mean, it would get up to maybe 100 feet, and he would fly for 7 or 8 minutes, and then he'd come down again very bumpy. But it was the first manned flight in Australia. Houdini always wanted to be first, and this was a way in which he could be first.
I want to ask about the subtitle of your book, a very big double meaning in it, Houdini, the Elusive American. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, it comes from a screenplay that he himself wrote. He titled it the Adventures of Houdini, the Elusive American. And so I'd sort of borrowed his title. To me, it was a bit ironic. One, the elusiveness is partly the fact that he had this slippery relationship with the truth that we mentioned earlier. And then the American part is his extreme desire to be an American and his very American life, which is to be an immigrant, to come here, to work extraordinarily hard and achieve huge success. He is a great classical American success story. And then the elusive thing, finally, you know, there are parts of every person, even somebody you've written a book about, that you don't know. And so for me, it's a tip of the hat to the fact that some things about Houdini I'll never understand.
Let's bring on one more caller. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hello.
Hi. There's a lot said about his relationship with his mother, and how close he felt to her. But I haven't seen much about his relationship with his father, and I'm guessing there's a lot of hostility. Can you tell me anything more about that?
Sure. I don't know if there is hostility. I think his father, I think there was a sort of absence, and I think that there was a disappointment with his father, that his father, who had been a kind of distinguished man, a learned man, couldn't adjust to America. His name is Samuel Mayer Weiss. He was, I believe, a gentleman. You know, it's hard to know from this distance exactly what he was like, but Houdini never had anything bad to say about him. And also, Houdini credited his father with having given him a love of books and learning. And Houdini went on to become a huge collector of books and of magic paraphernalia and of theater paraphernalia. He gave thousands and thousands of items to the Library of Congress when he died, for example. And so I think that his relationship with his father wasn't nearly as close as his relationship with his mother. But I wouldn't say that there was antagonism. I'd say that there was disappointment.
And briefly, Adam, there's been a lot of legend about Harry Houdini's cause of death. Probably don't have time to tell the whole story, but why has that continued to fascinate people for so long, just in our last 30 seconds or so?
Well, the fact is that Harry Houdini died after being punched in the stomach. And so a lot of people have jumped to the conclusion that he died because he was punched in the stomach. But in fact, he died of peritonitis, which comes from a burst appendix. And a burst appendix comes from a bacterial infection, not from trauma. The twist in all this is whether you believe that the spiritualists whom he was attacking were somehow behind the punch in the stomach. And if you believe that, then you might believe that that's what killed him. But I think it was bacteria.
And that's where we'll leave it. Thanks to author Adam Begley. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Houdini, the Elusive American. Covers the career of escape artist Harry Houdini from his birth in Hungary, his childhood here in Wisconsin, and his rise to stardom. Last week on Food Friday, we had a great conversation with cookbook author Dori Greenspan about our baking projects while we're staying at home a lot these days. Dori shared a lot of great advice and inspiration. You can listen to the whole thing archived over at WPR.org. She also shared a great recipe for Cabin Fever Caramel Banana Bars. You can get that at WPR.org/Food Friday. If you keep scrolling down, you can get dozens and dozens of Food Friday recipes from our guests over the years. You also shared some of your baking projects by calling in, and we've heard from some more of you over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here are a few of your responses. Sue says, I've been baking bread using several different recipes. My goal is a full-flavored, long-keeping white bread for toast or sandwiches. Haven't found a recipe yet that fills the bill. I'm not a new baker and have good equipment and ingredients available. Would appreciate a favorite recipe. Well, maybe you have that recipe that checks all those boxes for Sue. If so, go over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, find this discussion, and send her a reply. Hannah also chimed in. Hannah says, I've been baking country white buttermilk bread. Maybe that's the one Sue needs. Cinnamon rolls, tortillas, and paratha. Anna, that sounds really good. And then Kyle says, one of my favorite breads is challah, great for breakfast toasted or as a French toast. My recipe calls for 2 whole eggs or 4 egg yolks, much richer with all yolks. Well, I hope you're all doing some happy baking at home, whatever you like to make. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.